From Luminary and Built It Productions, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, Lena Nair, Global Head of HR at Unilever.
My job today is to be in the service of 170,000 people of Unilever. It's not to run HR and be a boss of a big function. It is to be in service of people. How can I build a better business, and by building a better business, better world?
Lena's journey from internship all the way up to the C-suite at one of the largest consumer products companies in the world.
Hi, this is Matt.
And Sean.
From Two Black Guys.
With good credit. From a local business to a global corporation.
Partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Generative AI is not a one-size-fits-all. If you're powering a customer chat experience, you need instant speed at low cost. If you're doing complex R&D or advanced analysis, you need frontier intelligence. The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic offers a model for every task and budget. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between speed and skill. And Haiku is the fastest and most cost-effective model on the market. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to power their AI solutions. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
No matter where you're listening to this podcast, chances are pretty good that right now you've got something made by Unilever. Unilever owns more than 400 brands, household names like Lipton Tea, Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, Dove Soap, and Dollar Shave Club, to name just a few. The company is over 90 years old, and it operates in more than 190 countries. So if you do have a Unilever product in your cupboard or freezer or bathroom, that's not particularly surprising. Something you might not know about Unilever, though, is that recently the company met a 10-year goal to achieve 50-50 gender balance in management across all of their global operations. And the person overseeing that goal, appropriately, was Lena Nair. Lena's worked for Unilever her entire career. And in 2016, Lena became the company's global head of human resources, overseeing its massive 170,000-person workforce. Now, this is not something Lena imagined for herself in 1992 in her native India. That's when she joined Unilever as a summer intern. At the time, Unilever in India was 98% male. And becoming the first female global chief of HR was definitely something Lena would have had trouble imagining. During her early years as a Unilever trainee in India, many of the factories she'd be sent to audit didn't even have women's bathrooms. I talked to Lena just a few weeks ago, and because of the global pandemic, she spoke to me from her home in London instead of at a recording studio. And out of all the situations she's faced, Lena says this crisis is the greatest challenge of her professional career and life, which, as you'll hear, is saying quite a lot.
I grew up in a place called Kolhapur. It's on the road from Bombay to Goa. It's famous for footwear. Kolhapuri chappals, everyone's heard of them in India. And my town's actually famous for making these.
And when you were a young girl, I mean, did you Did you have burning ambitions? Did you have a sense of what you kind of wanted to do in life?
I wish, Guy, I could say that, you know, I knew absolutely what I wanted to do, but it's far from the truth. You know, I grew up in a small town. I grew up in a joint family with 16 cousins. It wasn't a town where there were, you know, I can't think of any role models of women who worked. And there wasn't a proper school for girls. So the first sort of English medium school for girls came up in town when I was sort of 6 or 7. And we're still called the first batch of the first school that came up in town. So, you know, I grew up in a very humble surroundings in a small town with absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. In fact, one of the things I would always hear was, you know, as a woman, what are you going to achieve in life? Why are you so desperate to get educated? What are you going to do with it? And I remember being very, very upset when I was 6 or 7 and I sort of came running into a room where my mother was having a cup of tea, coffee with her neighboring friends, and they were having a little chat about their kids. And I heard my mom say that, you know, I wish Lena was a boy because, you know, she's talented. And now, you know, she's a girl and she's not going to be able to use any of those talents. And I remember being quite disappointed, sad, crushed, angry, many of the sentiments, and really young at that time, but I still remember it so vividly. So I just wanted to make a difference. I didn't know how. I didn't know what it was going to be. So my battle when I was growing up was really about saying, I want to get educated. I don't know if I'm going to apply it. I don't know if I'm going to ever have a career, but I love learning. And can I just be supported to learn?
Okay, so you went off to study engineering, and this was presumably what you sort of thought you were going to do with your life.
I took up engineering because I enjoyed maths and I enjoyed physics, and I did not enjoy biology. So there wasn't much of career counseling in those days, and I saw my cousin brothers were all going on to study engineering. So I thought, here I am, I'm going to go and study engineering. And, you know, I enjoyed engineering. I went on to work as a telecom engineer for about 3-4 months, and I just didn't like it. I was a lousy engineer. I mean, I enjoyed the intellectual challenge of problem solving, but I didn't actually enjoy applying engineering. And I had a wonderful mentor who really helped me understand that management might be a better career option for me, and that I loved commerciality. I loved business. I loved being around people. I was all about leadership, engagement, motivation. And he just sort of gently nudged me to think of management and to think of human resources.
So he was basically saying to you, hey, look, you know, I don't know about this engineering thing. It might really not be you for you. You might not be right at it. You know, it's a kind of a risky thing to say, because if you're someone's mentor and you say, look, you're not really cut out for this, but you might want to try this thing. I mean, it was very good advice, but it could have turned into the person that you thought, oh, this guy said I couldn't do it, but I still persevered. You know what I mean?
You know, that also working for 3-4 months as a telecom engineer, you know, I was bored out of my mind. I was waiting for lunchtime so I could interact with people. I was in an R&D laboratory and trying to understand more about fiber optics and picture-in-picture television. And, you know, my heart didn't sing. And you'll hear when I talk about purpose and passion, my heart didn't sing. So you know instinctively, okay, this is not where really I'm getting my zing from. I remember talking to my father and saying, who was a big sponsor for me and was, you know, the number one person in the family who said, yeah, she should get educated and we shouldn't worry about whether she's going to have a career or not. Let her just do what she needs to. I remember telling him that I wanted to do personnel. It wasn't even called human resources in those days. And he was so disappointed. He said, you know, why would you do this? Now that you've studied to be an engineer, why don't you do more things in engineering? So it was a tough moment being, you know, 20 years old and thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? And just feeling this incredible pull and draw to do human resources. But generally being, other than my mentor, most others thought it wasn't such a great idea.
Human resources is such a specific and I mean, especially for a young person to think this is really what I should focus on. How did you even know that that was going to be the right fit? Obviously it was, but how did you know at that point in your life?
You know, one of the things I talked to a lot of young people, including my sons, my young sons who are 21 and 18, is if you ask 10 people who know you well what you're really good at and what makes your heart sing, they can tell you. They can see it. And it's a little bit of that. I sort of instinctively had a draw and pull for this, but I didn't know it could have been a terrible mistake. But I was investing 2 years to do an MBA. It was not the end of the world. And I knew that if at the end of 2 years I came back thinking this wasn't for me, maybe I could go back and be an engineer.
Yeah.
As it happened, from the very first class, I sort of felt, this makes sense. I felt at home. But, you know, in many ways, learning to trust your instincts, learning to ask people around you, learning to trust your set of mentors has been part of some of my lifelong learnings.
It's amazing because you have spent your entire career with Unilever so far. You joined Unilever out of business school in India in 1992 as a trainee, as a summer trainee. Unilever has obviously huge, it's a multinational, it has huge facilities and production facilities all around the world, including in India. How did that happen? Were they recruiting on the campus?
On campus, recruiting on campus. I attended the campus interview. I joined as a summer intern for 2 months. I loved it. I loved the quality of people I was working with. I loved the quality of work. And then I was fortunate and blessed for them to come back and tell me they wanted me as a management trainee, or what we call the Unilever Leadership Future Leaders Program, what we call it today. We used to call it the Management Training Program in those days. And they came back and gave me an offer, and I grabbed it with both hands, and there's been no looking back.
Wow. So, all right, so you joined Unilever as a trainee. And what was your job? Well, I mean, because you presumably you're thinking, okay, you're already interested in HR and you're starting to think about HR, but that was not your first job there.
No, the first five, you know, the first couple of years as a management trainee, I spent in sales for 6 months. I was selling tea in Haryana in North India. That I was a salesperson. I ran personnel for factory. I understood about industrial relations. I can only think back with great happiness, pride, learning, call it what you may. I also realized pretty quickly that I was one among a very, very small group of women. In fact, I hold the record for being the first woman at many things in Hindustan Lever. I often say that I didn't break any glass ceilings, but I was actually breaking glass basements because, for example, I was the first woman to go and do a night shift in a factory that made margarine in India for Unilever. And I was the first woman who went and built a road along with rural villagers in Eta and so on and so forth. So I started the first footsteps into the privilege and the burden of being the first woman at many things in Hindustan Lever. So the first 6 years were a number of what I call grassroots experience. I learned what it takes to make our products, to sell our products, to work with unions. And I'm a big proponent of saying you must in a business really know what are the growth drivers of your business, how product gets made, how it gets sold. You must experience it. You must do it. So those were the first 6 years before I started moving into more and more human resource roles.
And eventually you became the general manager of HR for Unilever's division in India, right? Hindustan Unilever?
Yes, I became the general manager for the home and personal care business running HR for our largest division. And then I was on the board of Hindustan Lever as the executive director for human resource. And again, had the burden and privilege of being the first woman in 100 years on the board of Hindustan Lever as the executive director for human resource. So after my first 5-6 years in the business doing, like I said, grassroots roles, I did a number of roles and started partnering different divisions and then became the head of HR in 2007.
When you are running HR in such a complex and incredibly vibrant country like India, I mean, I can't even imagine what it entails, right, in terms of just the level of detail and the different types of employees. I mean, you've got everyone from presumably from people on the factory floor to people in C-suites that you are sort of shepherding through the process.
Absolutely.
Huge complexity. I'll give you some of the numbers. We had 46 factories with 96 trade unions, 15,000 wow. people in the business, and 100,000 people who sold for us in different, you know, they were merchandisers, distributors. So yes, it was massively exciting. Huge, complex, big scale. It's the third largest company in India in its market capitalization terms. So yes, you are in the spotlight, you are under focus. And Hindustan Lever also had a huge reputation for building a lot of the leaders for India Inc. It was called the CEO Factory of India and continues to be called that. So huge profile of building talent, not just for Hindustan Lever, but for India Inc. So massive honor and privilege for me to have done that job for, you know, 5 years of my life. And it built a lot of the skills that's helping me be the chief HR officer for Unilever today.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Generative AI is not a one-size-fits-all. If you're powering a customer chat experience, you need instant speed at low cost. If you're doing complex R&D or advanced analysis, you need frontier intelligence. The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic offers a model for every task and budget. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between speed and skill. And Haiku is the fastest and most cost-effective model on the market. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to power their AI solutions. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Lena, you were with a group of a senior team from Unilever in Mumbai in 2008 at the Taj Hotel when it was attacked by terrorists. I think most people listening will remember that horrifying story. Almost, I think, 200 people were lost their lives in that attack. And you were there. You had to, I guess, hide for 24 hours during that siege. What do you remember about it?
Guy, that was without a doubt one of the most difficult nights of my life and something that changed me as a person, as it would when you realize that you might not go back home to see your kids again. You know, my husband and I were both stuck in the Taj that night and, you know, hiding the entire night, having two boys, 9 and 5, sitting at home waiting for their parents to turn back after dinner. And seeing this horrific news on television that the Taj was being attacked. And, you know, without any doubt, it was a terrible night and one, you know, I wouldn't wish on my enemies. And hiding the whole night, hearing shotgun shots through the night, screams. It's just, you know, one of those things that change you forever. One of the things I remember from that night is the extraordinary bravery and courage of the staff in the Taj who worked so hard to get us to safety. there was a young girl, Malika Jagar, who was, you know, no more than maybe 23, 24. I remember her bravery and courage. I remember how much the staff tried hard to find places for us to hide, so there was a higher chance that, you know, one of us would survive among couples. And I also remember feeling after that and reflecting after that, that I would follow my heart with even more passion and even more intensity, because I don't want to waste my time in this world. I've been given a second chance. Not many people have had a second chance. I lost some friends, and you know, you in many ways feel more determined to give the best of yourself, to make it count, to do things that really matter to you, to your family, to your colleagues, to your company, to the world.
When you say it changed you, I mean, you were up until that point extreme. You were on the fast track. Clearly, you were identified by Unilever, not just in India, but at headquarters in the UK, as somebody who they needed to keep an eye on, who was going to go places. And you were rising up very quickly, the youngest and all of these roles and then this thing happens. And how did that change the way you thought about, I don't know, your career and your purpose? I mean, did it kind of make you rethink all of the ambition that you had had up until that point?
You know, I do think it brought a lot more maturity to the way I thought about career. Because even now, when I think about career, I stopped thinking destinations. I want to do this role, then be in that role, then sit in that seat. I became more thoughtful about trajectories. What is my trajectory of learning? What am I attempting to do in this? For example, my job today is to be in the service of 170,000 people of Unilever. It's not to run HR and be a boss of a big function. It is to be in service of people. How can I build a better business? And by building a better business, better world. I constantly think about things I do beyond Unilever. So for example, I think about how can I influence the investor community to give more importance to human resources and human capital. I'm in Davos every year for the last 4 years, and I'm speaking on forum after forum. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm putting out blogs out there all the time because I want to build a movement and a coalition of people who care about human beings and want people to feel fulfilled and happy. So in many ways, the intensity around my purpose grew sharper. And I'm so grateful for the platform that Unilever gives me, that I can use this platform, because Unilever is so respected for what it does as a company, for what it does for talent and people, that I already am lucky to have this platform where people are eager and keen to listen to my point of view because of the reputation that Unilever has.
Any organization, right? One of the key challenges is finding the right people for the right jobs, right? It's hiring well is an incredibly complex and difficult thing to do. And I know that one of the things Unilever has done and that you've kind of spearheaded that's really innovative, you've really kind of streamlined the process of finding the right people in part through by using AI, by using algorithms. Tell me what you're doing. How does that work?
You know, we have 2 million people who apply to us.
2 million?
Yes. And, you know, about 500,000 of them are graduates applying to us for 800 graduates that we take across the world. So for me, this was, you know, I think it's a very demotivating experience when you're so excited about Unilever and you're among these 2 million people. And, you know, when you apply to Unilever, if all you get is, thank you for applying to Unilever, we'll get back to you. And besides, I don't blame any of my teams, because 2 million people, even if I employ 5,000 recruiters, it's not enough to get through
2 million applications and do it any justice. So it's really that that we started working with, and we've sort of digitized the entire process. So when you're an applicant, a graduate training applies to us, you first upload your CV using LinkedIn. It's really a one second job. You do it. Then you play games. We've partnered with organizations like Biometrics, where we've created really strong games that help us understand who will be a great fit for Unilever. Then they go through an interview. They go through have a selfie video. And this selfie video is watched by our talent advisors, along with some technology to help them be able to go through 2 million selfie videos and make sense of what the person is doing. And then, of course, a smaller number go through what we call discovery centers. We don't even call them interviews because they spend a day and a half interacting with many of our leaders. And we actually look for fit because they're all bright, you know. So it's really more fit. But for me, the biggest win was all 2 million people who applied to us now get detailed feedback. They get two or three pages of, here's how you did on the games you played. Here were your biggest strengths. Here were the areas of development. Here are the things that make you a better candidate for Unilever because you fit with what we're trying to do. And it even gives suggestions saying, maybe you should think of consulting because you seem to have strengths in blah, 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 which might suit that environment more. So, you know, that's what I like the most, that finally the 2 million people feel like they've engaged and participated in a process and have got some meaningful feedback from the company. That's really what we're trying to drive. It's helped handle scale. It's helped humanize it. So high tech and high touch have to go together.
Lena, I want to ask you and dive a bit deeper into practices in HR, right? Because retention, retention is key, right? Because when you hiring, onboarding somebody, bringing somebody, first of all, finding the right person and then bringing them on board and then keeping them is expensive. It's very expensive to lose somebody. You've already invested a lot in bringing them on and training them and giving them skills. It's cost you a lot of money as an employer. So when you think about all of the priorities that you have as a leader of HR, is retention right near or right at the top?
You know, I must say that I believe if you work hard on engagement and motivation, you will land up retaining. I'll give you some numbers for Unilever. Our global attrition is less than 5%. What retains people is one, if they feel the stretch and challenge in what they're doing. The second thing that keeps people is when they feel that they can live their purpose and passion. People will stay when they feel they have leaders who provide them the empowerment and space. And they will stay if they feel they're rewarded and recognized for what they do. They're valued for who they are. So I feel that the harder we work on making sure people feel engaged with Unilever's purpose, feel engaged with their own purpose and what they want to do, they feel like Unilever cares about their well-being, about their learning, then we land up retaining them. I can tell you the fundamental reason that people leave are because they're not stretched, they're not valued, they have a boss who sucks. It's many of those reasons. It's never money. Money is a reason they might say because it's much more convenient to say somebody else gave me a package that was better than having the difficult conversation saying my boss is a difficult person to work with. So my advice is work on engagement and motivation. Retention will be an outcome of that.
You know, a lot of companies talk, and not just talk, but really vocally committed to diversity. Pretty much most Fortune 100 companies around the world, diversity is one of their core values, right? As it is with Unilever. And you have achieved, for example, 50-50 gender balance in managerial roles, which is super impressive. But I'm going to sort of ask you to play a thought experiment with me, which is for people who sort of hear the diversity thing and know that it's the right thing to do, or that, you know, culturally it seems like the right thing to do, but aren't doing it. What argument would you make to them that there is actually not just a moral downside, but a business and financial downside by not emphasizing diversity?
You know, one of the things, Guy, we did was invest in our top 1,000 leaders so that they really buy into why we need gender balance. You know, beyond a point, I have less patience for business case, and I'm famously, viral in a video that was, which I've never been viral before till this sort of video of me snapping and getting angry at Davos went viral, saying, "Show me a business case for why men are good for business, and I'll write you a business case for why women are good for business." You know, where's their business case saying men are good for business? We just assume it. It seems very easy. Half the world is women. Of course, we should have more women in our business. But that, not everybody buys that. So we actually invested time in our 1,000 leaders. For some, the business case appeals. The people who buy into it because they have daughters, and their daughters start asking the question, "Are you saying I'm going to go into a world where my brother has a better chance than me? Really, is that the world you're building?" And that makes them think. For some, it's the talent angle. For some, it's the moral angle. So you've got to convince your top 1,000, 2,000 leaders in whatever way they best buy into it, that there's rational, emotional, moral, risk, all sorts of reasons for doing this. So we did lots of wonderful things. We focused on numbers and we focused on culture. We did both. So in numbers, we ensured that every job you appoint for has to have a balanced slate. They have to be as many talented women that you find as men. We instituted into place what we call gender appointment ratios. We said simple gender appointment ratios is in 5 years, how many opportunities you had to make an appointment in your patch, how many times you appointed a man, how many times you appointed a woman. Simple. If you have a gender appointment of ratio one, it means for all the opportunities you had, you appointed equal number of men and women. So it just threw a spotlight on the leaders who are simply not making progress. Because in 5 years, if you've not been able to make decent appointments, you really have to question yourself, saying, what's going on here? So it's a combination of immense leadership commitment and focusing on numbers, focusing on culture. So it's a combination of all of these things.
Lena, you oversee 170,000 employees around the world. And I mean, obviously, you're dealing with so many different types of workplace cultures and environments, right? I mean, the workplace in Germany is very different from the workplace in the UK, or, you know, Korea is very different from the workplace in Japan. I mean, the workplace in India is super different from the workplace in Jordan or in Lebanon. But as the head of HR for a worldwide company, how do you like reconcile those differences?
You know, Guy, you touched upon a very important thing. You know, one of the biggest joys of my job is that one size doesn't fit all.
Yeah.
I always have to think about this. I have to flex everything we do to make it relevant to the context we are in. I give a very simple example, you know, remote working, working out of home, which has now become all of our reality with COVID. When we went to do a lot of agile and remote working as part of a diversity and inclusion agenda, you know, people in Europe said, "Great, I love this. You know, it works for me." People in Japan said, "No, I'm not sure I want to do this. We have smaller houses and I'm not sure I want to set up office in my house." The women in Pakistan said, "Listen, my mother-in-law lives with me, and if I'm working, she thinks I'm available to talk. It doesn't work for me." Women in Saudi Arabia said, "You know, I actually want to get out to the office for a few hours a day for a, you know, for a cheat." So something that looks so simple, that we're giving you the flexibility to work out of home anytime you wish, wasn't joyfully received in all parts of the world with the same enthusiasm. So it's taught me many lessons on how our people programs have to be nuanced for the context they are in, have to be flexed, have to be translated into the context, both literally as in language translations, but also figuratively to make it relevant for the population that we're speaking of in that country.
Lena, we're in the midst of the greatest global health crisis in living history, right? There's been nothing like this since 1918, and certainly for virtually everybody who's alive today. A huge challenge for all businesses. Many businesses will not survive this. A company like Unilever is resilient. It's huge. And so it probably will be able to weather this storm better than others. But there's no question that you will face some very difficult decisions if you haven't already, in terms of staffing, personnel, layoffs, furloughs, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about some of these hard decisions that you are already finding yourself having to make.
You know, I really, really passionately believe that when we're going through a crisis like this, a company like Unilever has to protect its workforce and protect the pay. We're one of the first companies to go out there saying we are going to protect the pay of our workforce, which means our employees, contractors, and others for 3 months. So that's the first thing. Now, the way we're approaching it for our people, we're framing it in three buckets. We say protecting our people, which is protecting lives and livelihoods of our people. When I say people, not just the immediate 170,000, but the more than double that number that work for us every day. You know, people who clean our offices for us, people who, you know, run our catering, and people who sell for us, and our merchandisers and shops in Indonesia, our entire ecosystem, we've said we'll protect the pay. The second bucket is ensuring business continuity, which is ensuring our products are needed by consumers more than ever. Sanitizers, hand cleansers, food products. You know, we are, the humble soap is our best defense against coronavirus till vaccines come. So ensuring business continuity is a big part of our people program. And the last bucket is future-proofing our business. How are we ensuring people are using the time to get skilled if they have free time that's free because now they no longer have to commute? How do we ensure they're learning the skills even while sitting at home? How do we ensure they're thinking about the new normal and the way business and world is going to change, and creating products and services that make meaning to consumers once we're through the intensity of this? So I do think as a company, we must try to protect our lives and livelihoods as long as we can. But we must use everything in our power to find the savings in our balance sheet to make possible this looking after our people, which means recruitment, salary increases, redistribution, reallocation, really being clever about all the levers in our control, less travel, saving on things that you, events, who's doing events anymore? A company like Unilever has conferences, events, meetings, loads of them happening all the time. You know, this is a year that's not going to happen. So squeeze everything you can out of the non-people line and find a way to make your people productive and contributing to this crisis.
Would you say, and I think I know the answer to this because I think it's probably the answer for most people, that you are now in the midst of the greatest, not just challenge that you have seen for Unilever, but personal professional challenge in your career?
Yes. This is the most unprecedented thing I've ever faced in my life. And I've been through terrorist attacks and I've been through a whole host of things I can tell you about. But this is by far the biggest, most complex, the most difficult to understand. This is the time to truly put people first. And if we take care of their safety and we make them feel brave and we support their livelihoods and they feel we care about their livelihoods, they will put their entire focus and attention on getting the business to survive and thrive during these very, very difficult times.
That's Lena Nair, Global Chief Human Resources Officer at Unilever. In addition to her role at Unilever, Lena serves on the board of British Telecom, and she's been named by the Indian magazine Business Today as one of the top 25 most powerful women in business for 7 years in a row. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary and Built It Productions.
Generative AI is not a one-size-fits-all. If you're powering a customer chat experience, you need instant speed at low cost. If you're doing complex R&D or advanced analysis, you need frontier intelligence. The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic offers a model for every task and budget. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between speed and skill. And Haiku is the fastest and most cost-effective model on the market. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to power their AI solutions. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.